necessary to take a drink since October 30th of 1988, and for that I'm truly, truly grateful. One day at a time. I want to thank the No Reservations host committee for making this opportunity possible. The communications over the months to put this together, the dress rehearsal yesterday, it's all just fallen into place so beautifully. And I want to thank each and every one of you for coming. I would like to open this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the serenity prayer. God,
grant us serenity to respect the things we cannot change, the courage to change things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
I have much more than an hour's worth of material, so I'm going to be moving fairly quickly. Please bear with me. Dick did the introduction. Yes, we are going to talk about the writing of the big book. And in the second session after the break, we're going to talk about AA's unsung heroes, Ann Smith and Lois Wilson. I'm an AA archivist historian. I live in Tucson, Arizona, the arid zone. As beautiful as this picture looks, I couldn't get out of there fast enough to come up here. Whoa, it's been a brutal summer. But it's the ideal location for the conservation and preservation of archival materials. Paper does not get moldy or mildew, and books don't have foxing, which is a fungus. It's just perfect. I have 100,000 pages of AA archival materials and over 5,000 books. Dick has actually been to the world headquarters of our little operation, which is a garage, so they can validate. We operate out of garage. We do this for fun and for free. I make no money from the sale of any literature that has my name on it. This is my gift to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my 12-step work for which I cannot be paid. What an honor that is. In terms of my journey, in addition to being a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, in 1992 I was elected to be the Arizona Area Archivist. An archivist is a keeper of AA's records. Historian is a storyteller, so I am also, in addition to a keeper of the records, a storyteller. That's why I am an archivist and historian. In 1994, I was elected to the National Archives Study Committee, reported to the General Service Office in New York. And as of 1999, I've been the caretaker of the Dr. Bob and Ann Smith Personal Archives in Akron, Ohio. I travel all over the world. That and part of what came out of that archives you're going to see this afternoon in terms of my tribute to Ann Smith. I try to schedule an archival visit to some repository during each of my visits around the country. In this time, I'm in St. Louis, Missouri, and they took me to the Father and Dowling collection. And it was there that I found the oldest reference to the beginners' meetings, even older than anything that I put in anything that I've published. I just want to take a minute on that. I do have copies of that. We can actually bring copies out if that's okay during the break. I'd like to read just a bit of it to you so you understand why we had a 50 to 75% recovery rate in the 1940s. I'm going down to the third paragraph. Now, therefore, accordingly and hereafter, this is the Executive Committee of St. Louis. Obviously, in terms of my take, and if it's my opinion, I'll make sure I qualify that, that somebody on that committee must have been an attorney to open that. Now, therefore, accordingly and hereafter, any member who may slip after June 12, 1942, and any member who shall be absent without reasonable cause for three Wednesday meetings, I only have one meeting a week, During any 1 month shall be considered a member in suspension and will be expected to be present in at least 4 consecutive instruction meetings before being eligible to attend any other group function or take part in any group activity. The name of the member so in suspension who refuses to so improve himself and to so reaffirm his sincerity shall be stricken from the roster of the group.
Oh,
I know. I just found this a couple of years ago. This is an amazing piece of our history. Next paragraph. Now, all new members coming into the group are obligated to attend at least 4 consecutive instruction meetings, i.e. the beginner's meetings, in addition to the privilege of attending the regular group functions. Yes. Taking the steps was not an option. Taking the steps is what you did as soon as you got here. And we'll talk more about that during the course of the weekend. Again, I do get the opportunity to tell my story tonight, and we are going to do a 2-hour presentation on sponsorship tomorrow, right here in this room, 1 to 3. I like to subtitle the sponsorship presentation, How to Sponsor and Be Sponsored Through the Steps in 2 Hours or Less. Whoa, now there's some controversy. They talk about 4 hours here. And the beginner's meetings were based on taking the steps in 4 hours. And hundreds of thousands of people did that. And I personally believe that it was a major contribution to our 50 to 75% recovery rate. Here I am in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, going through the Reverend Sam Shoemaker archives. We did not even know that there was an archival collection in Pittsburgh. This lady only works between 1 and 4 on Friday afternoons. And we showed up just to get our picture taken at 2 o'clock, and she gave us the keys to the kingdom. She gave us the codes for 3 copy machines, and we walked out of there with 5,000 pages of material. One of the things that came from there is a letter that Bill wrote to Shep Cornell indicating that Bill was co-sponsored into AA. I know in his story he only mentions Abby, but here we have the opportunity to see the rest of the story. This is March 22nd, 1946. Dear Shep, your cordial note via Sam Shoemaker, came the other day and it was most appreciated. Then too it stirred up many happy recollections of that time more than 10 years ago when you and Abby paid me the visit that changed my whole life. In fact, saved it. So please accept my thought of gratitude as something very real indeed. Co-sponsorship was common. Abby was co-sponsored. Bill was co-sponsored. Dr. Bob was co-sponsored. Bill D, AA number 3, was co-sponsored. Of course, by Bill and Bob. But co-sponsorship was an integral part of the 1940s. We'll talk about that more in depth and detail tomorrow. Also, I got the opportunity to go through the archives of the Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. It took 2 years to get cleared in there. You had to have a letter of recommendation from an Episcopal priest, plus 2 letters of recommendation from archivists. And coming out of that archival collection, this was the material in Sam Shoemaker's desk. All the time that Bill was sitting there writing the big book. Much of the big book was written in Sam's office. This was one of the posters that was put together for the Calvary Mission. This is where Emmy was staying in 1934. And we actually have a meeting at the mission in 1934. I have scoured the photograph pretty closely. I don't see Bill in the photo or Abby, but that's what the meetings look like that saved Bill's life in the fall, early winter of 1934. Now, again, anything that has been altered, I will be the first to tell you. I have altered this this little pamphlet. This pamphlet predates the How to Listen to God pamphlet that is used by a lot of people to conduct 11 steps. This is from the 1920s. And you can see that the steps as laid out, they actually said steps on the stairway to something else. I'm the one who put recovery in there to bring it up to date. And I do have it at the bottom of the handout that I have modified and I have edited it. But look at the six steps as they existed. Now, Bill, when he left the Oxford Group, converted the four steps to six, and then the six was converted to 12. But here in the 1920s, they had six steps. Surrender, practice the four standards of honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. Share, keep the quiet time. Obey the guidance, change others. An amazing source documentation from the 1920s. And again, I'm just pontificating. I'm imagining Bill sitting behind Sam's desk, and he's got all of Sam's books on the wall that were used as source documents for the big book. We'll get into that later this hour. And this pamphlet's on the desk. Steps. Six sounds like a pretty good number. Let me convert those four from the Oxford Group to something else. Very, again, my take, totally and completely. We don't have a paper trail on it. Oh, again, as an archivist, in order to present, we have to have three pieces of paper in order to validate that it is historically accurate. Two pieces of paper, one oral history is not quite as good, but still sufficient. One paper, two oral is pretty iffy. No paper, three oral, we will not share from a podium. We have no validation that it is our history. Much of what you hear in the rooms is not historically accurate, I'm sorry to say. I did get the opportunity to travel to Washington, D.C. Most people go to the Library of Congress and go to the front door. I am as blessed can be to be going in the back door of the Library of Congress to do research. It's for staff and researchers only. I do have my Library of Congress research card. This is probably the only photograph you'll ever see of the Great Room. This is not open to the public. This is only open to researchers. I walked in the room. I couldn't believe where I was. I immediately took out my camera, took a photograph, turned around, and saw all the signs that says, no photographs. So I went to the center of the room and made my confession, tried to make my nice step amends. And they said, no, go ahead, keep it. Pass it on. So I am. What a great place to do research. Yeah, and what a long, strange trip it's been. I've got a gentleman in the back of the room wearing a Jerry Garcia slogan. I've got my Jerry Garcia tie on. And it has been a long, strange trip. I'll talk about this tonight. I had my conversion experience in Dr. Bob's living room in Akron, Ohio. It was a speaker meeting, and the only requirement to speak is you had to have 40 years of sobriety. Every person at that meeting had been sponsored by Dr. Bob. Every person at that meeting had taken the steps in one day. Every person in that room was sponsoring within a week. And they're the one, and I dedicated my life to studying the history of AA ever since that conversion experience of Dr. Bob's living room. I'm certainly not the first person to go around the country taking people through the steps in a day or 2 hours, 4 hours. This is a man in the late 1940s taking people through the steps. Long form of the traditions had just come out, so he's wearing the Lone Ranger mask. And he's actually right at that point in time taking people through the assets and liabilities checklist on the fourth step. And the concept was is that if you didn't deal with these liabilities that he had wrapped around whiskey bottles, you would end up drinking the whiskey. Take the steps or die. I do numerous archival presentations. This is the first chance I've had to present in this area. Just want to let you know that there's a lot more material that we can talk about over the years to come. In 1996, I met James H. We met at the Wilson House in East Dorset, Vermont. This is where Bill was born in 1895. And James, when I met him, was 90 years old and 61 years sober, just sober one day after Bill. He's not a co-founder or a tri-founder because he stayed in the Oxford Group and tried to save it when Bill left the Oxford Group in the fall of 1937 to start what was later to become Alcoholics Anonymous. But Jim was there when Bill wrote the big book. They went to meetings together, and he knew Bill W. quite well. And, he passed away at 100 years of age, 71 years sober. He has the record right now. But I'm sure some young person gets sober in their teens or 20s is going to break that record. And hopefully not too far distant future. Again, we traveled throughout the United States for 10 years. James always got top billing. Him and Sue Smith Windows, Dr. Bob's daughter, became the best of friends. And I truly believe that's part of the reason that I was designated to be the caretaker of the Dr. Bob and Ann Smith Archives as a result of their relationship. Sue would say every time I closed my eyes listening to Jim, I could hear my dad speaking. They had the same accent, they had the same inflection, and they had the same message. James is 98 years old, carrying the message here. 98 years old. In Phoenix, Arizona. Some of his words of wisdom. These are a few of the James Help one-liners. Our objective is to narrow the gap between what we believe and the way we live. God can't heal what we won't reveal. We can climb to the top of the ladder and we can find this leaning against the wrong wall. Yeah, these are classic hugs. What we think, say, or do either makes us part of the problem, or part of the solution, part of the disease, or part of the cure. It's not who is right, but what is right. And this is the one that has made such a difference in my life. We can either live in the past and make excuses, or live in the present and make a difference. How cool is that? I've never heard anybody else share anything like this before. And then in 1999, Sue was quite ill, and she called me when she was released from the hospital and said, there's 2 million people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're the only person I trust to find a home for Mom and Dad's stuff. And I flew to Akron, and she took me up in the attic, and I spent 4 days cataloging the archives, and I've been the caretaker of that collection ever since. The originals are all at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. I only have copies. Okay, in terms of who we are, I'm actually going to skip this section. We'll save this for my next trip. And I want to get right into the Oxford Group and the writing of the big book. So what I normally open with is, again, a tribute to AA and all the great things that AA has done for the world over the years. Again, this is the original Man in the Bed. Some people have seen the oil painting of the man in the bed. But again, this man in the detox, or the jitter joint is what they used to call them back then, is being co-sponsored through the work. In our big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have all four editions here for you at the table. And AA's ancestors. I want to take a few minutes on the Oxford Group. In the 1920s and 1930s, a movement swept the United States that was the direct forerunner of Alcoholics Anonymous. The organization was called the Oxford Group. The Oxford Group was founded by Frank Bookman, a Lutheran minister. It was a movement that believed that people's lives could be changed by following a few simple spiritual principles. And they were. This is the program upon which AA is based. The four standards of honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. Bill took these four standards as a test for God's will, reversed them, and gave them to us as a test for self-will in steps 4, 10, and 11, so he wasn't accused of direct plagiarism. But the four standards, whether it be the Oxford Group four standards or the opposites in AA, gives us a yardstick for measuring our growth and recovery. Honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love permeate the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The four spiritual activities to overcome all difficulties. These were surrender, which became our steps 1, 2, and 3. Sharing, our steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. Restitution, our steps 8 and 9. And guidance, our steps 10, 11, and 12. And the concept of two-way prayer. This involved both talking to and listening to the God consciousness within. During these quiet times, the listener would receive guidance and direction for his or her life. Our step 11. So these are the principles of Bob. These are the steps that Bill took. These are the steps that Bob took. These are the steps that James took. These are the steps that the first 100 took, because the 12 steps had not been written. They were written within 2 months of the publication of the book in December 1938. Now, I should say the publication of the multi-list, and then the book itself was published in April, but the multi-list started coming out at the end of January, 1st of February. In terms, and this is the Oxford Group's big book. It's called What is the Oxford Group? It was written anonymously. Again, they tried to stay anonymous, much like we do. Written anonymously in 1933. And the four spiritual activities are in this book. And these are the steps that were taken by Bill, Bob, and the pioneers. Surrender. Surrender of our life, past, present, and future, in God's keeping and direction. Sharing. The sharing of our difficulties with another life given to God, and to use sharing as witness to help others feel unchanged, to recognize and acknowledge their difficulties. Restitution, which Bill converted to amends. I'm glad he did. Shortened it up a little bit. Restitution to all who we have harmed. Oops. Restitution to all whom we have wronged, directly or indirectly. And guidance. Listening to, accepting, relying on God's guidance, and carrying it out in everything we do or say, great or small. So whether you're taking 4 steps or 12 steps, the process is the same, and the results were the same. People recovered from alcoholism. People recovered from other afflictions. People recovered from relationship issues, from smoking issues, from drug issues. It was so, so successful. So the Oxford Group produced one of the most important events in modern history. On May 12, 1935, a meeting took place between Bill W., a New York City stock analyst, and Dr. Bob S., an Akron, Ohio physician that changed the course of history. Not just the history of alcoholism, but the history of the world. Here were two alcoholics, neither of whom could stay sober by themselves, who found that if they worked for their mutual benefit, they were able to stay sober together. Now I'm going to examine how the big book was written, because it started with two, and then it became 8 and then 10. When they decided to actually write a book in 1937, there were approximately 40 people that were going to meetings. When the book came out, it says that 100 men, there weren't even 100 people had ever been to a meeting. We've only been able to count somewhere between 72 and 76. Bill loved to round off. And of course he's going to round off. But they knew they had to write a book. And in terms of writing that book, I want to start, before I get into the details of writing the book, I want to take a minute on divine coincidences. If you take and make a square and put it over a map of Manhattan and the outlying areas of New York City, basically within 2 square miles, you have Sam Shoemaker, the leader of the Oxford Group in the United States. You have Emmett Fox, the leader of the New Thought Movement, a lot of people suggested that this be required reading for members when they first come into AA. Several of Emmett Fox's books. Bill's concept of the power of man, the human power, very much mirrors the New Thought movement, the God of love and compassion and forgiveness and understanding. A lot of that came directly from Emmett Fox. Richard Peabody, he was one of the leaders of the Emmanuel movement. I do an entire separate presentation on the Emmanuel movement. The Emmanuel movement is the first organization that discovered something that's integral to our way of life. Drunks helping drunks. They have a little jitter joint behind the Emmanuel Church in Boston, Massachusetts. And in 1909, they started trying to sober up alcoholics. And what they found is that those that went through the little detox in the back of the church didn't necessarily stay sober. But those that came back to help the newcomers did stay sober. And they wrote a whole book on that. They called it Lay Therapy. No professionals, no credentials, just drunks working with drunks. And the drunks that came back stayed sober. And they put it into a book. And that's three. And the fourth was Bill W. They all knew each other. They all traveled together. They all learned from each other. Much of our big book is based upon the Oxford Group, the Emmanuel Movement, and the New Thought Movement. Why? Because Bill knew these people. Some of the source documents that Bill used to write the big book. The first one is Twice Born Men by Harold Bigby, also written in 1909. This book had to do with some people who were trying to sober up alcoholics within the Salvation Army. The reason this book is of interest is because the beginning of the book contained a very limited program of recovery, but it's what they knew at the time, and they put it on paper. But the back of the book contains stories of people who had recovered, and some of those stories are just as colorful, if not more colorful, than anything in our big book. So this is where Bill got the idea of putting the text, the program of recovery in the front, and stories in the back. Twice Born Men. What is the Oxford Group? I mentioned that. Since Bill and Bob were members of the Oxford Group, they're quite familiar with the Oxford Group for spiritual activities described in detail in the book. The Varieties of Religious Experience by William James. This is actually mentioned in our big book. Has anybody tried to read the Varieties of Religious Experience? Oh, wow. We've got quite a few people.
I see a few. This is hard to read.
It is a post-doctoral dissertation on spirituality. And here we're supposed, Bill loved to embellish. He said that Evie brought him this book in his second day of detox, and he read it and realized that he had a genuine conversion experience. Okay, Bill. my own take on it. If you turn to the last chapter, forget the rest of the book, it's about 400 pages. If you just turn to the last chapter, there's a summary of the conversion experiences, and it's about four pages long. I think Bill went straight to the heart of the matter. We got down to cause and conditions real fast. Again, my own personal opinion on that. But the thing that William James gave us, there are two ways to have a conversion experience. Either through great knowledge or great pain. Now, I don't know about the knowledge part. I certainly don't qualify there. But great pain, I can identify with that. That's why when Bill writes, we are rocketed into a fourth dimension, We go places that other people will never even imagine, let alone visit. We end up so low, and we get this conversion experience and travel so high in this fourth dimension of existence. Thank you, William James, for telling us that a way to have a conversion experience is through great pain. This Believing World by Lewis Brown, which was a very controversial book at the time, the author took all the religions of the world and concluded that when you sift through all the ritual, dogma, and belief systems, you come up with one higher power. Universal. And that's why Bill wrote a spiritual book and not a religious book. Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. Again, this is one of the books that many pioneers consider to be required reading. Fox was part of the New Thought movement. He had a theological background and he preached from hotel ballrooms on Saturday nights. Bill and Lois Wilson regularly attended his sermons. Fox described a universal power, a cosmic consciousness, which became the power greater than human power that Bill came to believe in. Common Sense of Drinking by Richard Peabody. Again, I mentioned this is the Emmanuel Movement link. He was one of the leaders of the Emmanuel Movement. Bill actually paraphrased some of the book. For example, on page 82, Richard Peabody writes, "Once a drunkard, always a drunkard," which Bill converted on page 33, "Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic." On page 83, Richard Peabody writes, "One of the reasons that may make it difficult for an inebriate to reform permanently is an idealization of the past, which he futilely believes he can relive, a belief often unexpressed with which he fools himself over and over again. This time, it is going to be different." How many have listened to that story? On page 30, Bill gives us the idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Page 99, like I said, Bill, they all knew each other. They all borrowed from each other. Page 99 is the classic. It reads, "A man must make up his mind to do everything in his power to cooperate in such work as there is to be done. Halfway measures are of no avail." Now, Bill used this quote almost verbatim in chapter 5 of the book. Another source document is "When Man Listens" by Cecil Rhodes, another Oxford Group book. It includes a set of promises. Now, in our book, the ones that are most prominent are the fifth step promises, the ninth step promises. The book is filled with promises. There are people who have written essays on over 200 promises in the big book. I love reading about all the promises. These are Richard Peabody's promises. Let's see, do I have them? Yes, I do. Okay. "This inner struggle, if it is thorough and honest, is met at once from God's side." And this is what we would call step 6 and 7. This would be like a second surrender. When we hand over, God takes charge and things happen. "A world of strain falls from us. The business of running life is off our hands. We find that we get through more work because it's being ordered better. We meet people we are afraid of and discover that fear has gone. A habit that always beat us seems to have lost its power. Someone we could not bear appears to us in a new life, and we love them. We come through an ordeal and know that it was not by our own strength." Thank you, Cecil Rhodes. Thank you, Bill, for giving us the rewrites. Bill started writing the big book in the spring of 1938. In 2 months, he had completed 2 chapters. He wrote his story, "And There Is a Solution." He took them down to Harper's Publishing Company. An editor said, "Mr. Wilson, do you think you can finish this book?" And Bill said, "Of course I can." Actually, he said, "Sure." And the editor replied, "We'd like to give you a $1,500 advance as an incentive to do so." $1,500. Well, Bill wrote his story, and there's a solution. And that's those are the two chapters he brought down. $1,500 is equivalent to $30,000 today. Here's a man who had not worked in 10 years. Lois had been supporting him the entire time, and here Hopper is offering him $1,500. Well, he takes this offer back to the group, which at the time was called the Nameless Bunch of Drunks. That's the name of the New York group. The Akron group was called the Alcoholic Squadron of the Oxford group. The New York group was called the Nameless Bunch of Drunks. We didn't have a name yet. And he takes it back and he tells the folks at the meeting, and then he's been offered $1,500. And what we see is our tradition starting to form here. And that is we decided to publish the book ourselves. Hank Parkhurst, who was Bill's spark plug, this was AA number 2 in New York City. He was a past executive with Standard Oil of New Jersey. He had drank his way out of the oil industry, out of the oil business, but he still had a very solid business ground. He said, "Bill, if there's $1,500 in it for you, there's going to be millions of dollars in it for us. Let's publish the book ourselves." So Hank formed this corporation and started issuing stock certificates. Works Publishing, Inc. The company was supposed to have been incorporated in the state of New York, but Hank never bothered to file the incorporation papers. So what he was selling was not only worthless, but phony stock certificates. Ladies and gentlemen, this is our history. This is how the book got written. $25 a share. Again, keep in mind, that's $500 a share in today's money. The deal was based on selling 100,000 copies of the book the first year. I mean, it's just an honor to see, you know, what was done in the name of saving the lives of alcoholics. Even twisting the legal system a little here and there along the way. But this is the prospectus that they released with the stock certificates. And this is the deal. They knew they were going to sell 100,000 copies of the big book the first year. If they did, you got your $25 back plus 150. If they only sold 50,000 copies, you still get your money back plus 75. Worst case scenario, if they only sold 15,000 copies, you'd get your money back plus $10. That's still a pretty good return on investment. 25 today, 35 next year. The stock certificates turned out to be worthless because they sold less than 1,000 copies of the book during the first year. Yeah. Ruth Hawk, Hank's secretary, who did all the typing for the book, was paid one stock certificate a week. Woo! Hey, Ruth, don't spend it all in one place. Basically, she had some well-to-do parents, and she basically typed the book for free. They did sell $5,000 in stock, plus they received a $2,500 loan from Charlie Towns. So, Charlie Towns, Towns Hospital, this is where Bill got sober in December 1934. So the $7,500 would be $150,000 to actually publish the book. Bill continued to write. Actually, he dictated the book to Ruth from notes he had made. This was a very, very important part of trying to understand what happened after chapters 1 and 2. 1 and 2 were well scripted, there were rough drafts, there were intermediate drafts, there were final drafts. From then on, it's Bill dictating off the top of his head. That's why it's a book that only alcoholics can comprehend. Normies don't get it. It's a stream of consciousness. There's no linearity to it whatsoever. I mean, we're in the middle of talking about agnostics, and then somebody's out there walking in front of buses and whiskey and milk. And, I mean, it just goes on and on. It's a stream of consciousness. And the name of the corporation they formed was the 100 Men Corporation, and the title of the book was to be 100 Men. That is, until a lady by the name of Florence R. stumbled into the room in late 1938. What's amazing is that, and that's it, 100 Men Corporation, name of the book, 100 Men. Florence's story is in the first edition. It's in the reprints of the first edition, A Feminine Victory. What's amazing is that she stayed sober just long enough to change the name of the book. She started drinking again in 1939, and she died drunk in 1941. But she was with us just long enough to help save our fellowship. She said, I hear you talking about this book. I want you to know I'm here. I'm here. I want you to call the book 100 Men and One Woman. Well, they realized they couldn't call the book 100 Men and One Woman. They also realized they couldn't call the book 100 Men either. So they went searching for a new title. The Way Out, The Way, The Empty Glass, The Dry Frontier, The Bill W. Movement. I'm not sure who floated that one, but. And then a man by the name of Joe Weirden attends one meeting and one meeting only. He was the past editor of the New Yorker magazine, but he drunk himself into oblivion. He had a wet brain and had been committed to the state insane asylum. Some of the staff at the asylum had heard that Bill Wilson was working with alcoholics, and they released Joe so he could go to a meeting. He got drunk immediately after the meeting and never saw the light of day again until the mid-1940s. But during the meeting, he says, I hear you talking about all these names for a book. Why don't you name the book after yourselves? Why don't you call it something like Anonymous Alcoholics? Because that's what you are. You're trying to remain anonymous, and you're all alcoholics. You include himself. Silence. Anonymous Alcoholics, Anonymous Alcoholics. And he said, well, then how about Alcoholics Anonymous? And Bill replies, Alcoholics Anonymous what? What's the subtitle? Alcoholics Anonymous, period. And that is the unofficial title of our book. That period came from that meeting. Nothing more needs to be said. We are Alcoholics Anonymous, period. I do believe in our singleness of purpose. I do believe in identifying myself as an alcoholic in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, period. Based upon that first edition, which that dust jacket was used from 1939 until 1955. And then the title of the book was finally decided upon in Fitz Mail at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. Yay, Library of Congress, to check on various titles. He sent back a telegram and read, 25 books titled The Way Out, 12 The Way, 0 Alcoholics Anonymous, and clinched it. And when the book went to the publisher in April 1939, which was in weeks of this incident, he said not all the 100 Men references had been removed from the book. The book, as released, still contained 3 references to the original title. Title page, How More Than 100 Men Have Recovered from Alcoholism. There is a solution. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know 100 men who are just as hopeless as Bill. Back cover, How More Than 100 Men Have Recovered from Alcoholism. We came very close to this book being titled 100 Men, and if it was released as 100 Men, I'm not sure if it ever would have caught on the way it has. Thank you, Florence. Thank you, Jill. And the book was, much of the book was written in Sam Shoemaker's office at the Calvary Church. Other parts of it were written at 17 Williams Street, New Jersey. We were able to get into the building just before it was condemned and torn, well, it was already condemned and torn down. We kind of just took down some plywood and in we went. So we could walk where Bill walked when he was pacing the floor, dictating to Ruth. And then we have William Silkworth wrote a letter for us, dated July 27, 1938, saying that AA was a good thing, and this was a medical doctor actually going out on a limb for us. But the big book certainly didn't change the course of the world right away. Bill and Hank were expecting the book to go out in carload lots, and people would be flocking in, but that wasn't the case, even after they received some national publicity. In the spring of 1939, an arrival fresh out of the Greystone Asylum, same place that Joe Worden was quickly pressed into service. Morgan R., a vibrant, red-headed Irishman, told the group that a popular radio journalist, Gabriel Heater, was willing to interview him on his nationwide broadcast of We the People on April 25th, again, within weeks of the publication of the book. The group was excited about the prospect of some national publicity, but their excitement quickly turned to concern when they realized that if Morgan was drunk the night of the broadcast, it would be a disaster for them and the book. So what did they do? They locked him up. They put him on 24/7 watch in the hotel room for a week. He did make it to the radio broadcast. I have read the transcript for that broadcast. He's only a couple months sober, and he made such a glowing endorsement for Alcoholics Anonymous. Phenomenal on that radio broadcast. But Hank went out and started circulating about tens of thousands of penny postcards to every doctor and psychiatrist east of the Mississippi River, announcing the broadcast with the people and buy this book. Well, guess what? After the radio broadcast, they went down to the post office box. They had 12 replies. 10 of them were written by people who were obviously under the influence at the time. Some really did not think well of this idea of alcoholics working with alcoholics. And they had 2 book sales, $7, equivalent to $140, $180 today. Then the New York Times reviewed the book on June 25th, 1939, and this review was very negative. The way it is written up, I'm just going to do a summary. Alcoholics Anonymous is unlike any other book ever published. The thesis of the book, as we read it aright, is this all-embracing and all-commanding idea that recovery must be religious. You see, they totally missed the spirituality of the program. And the review ends, most reviewers will pass this book by, most readers will pass this book by. It is a strange, strange book. Thank you, New York Times. So no books are being sold based on that review. And then Bert T., Bert's in the upper right, Emmy's in the upper left, Bill's in the middle. Lois is lower left, and we think that might be Bert's wife, lower right. Bert Taylor, had a tailor shop in Manhattan on Fifth Avenue. He mortgaged his tailor shop for $1,000 to keep AA going. AA was not able to pay him back. He lost his tailor shop. He lost his business. And if things just couldn't get any worse, they did. The last chapter of the book, the last story of the book was called The Lone Endeavor. A man who had written a letter before the book was finalized, saying he'd gotten sober just reading Multilith. So they put his story in. Summer of 1939, they passed the basket, got enough money for bus fare, and asked Pat Cooper to come to New York, which he did. And the New York group was there to meet the bus. Nobody came out fitting Pat Cooper's description. Bill goes on the bus. Have you seen anybody that looks like this anywhere along the line? And the guy said, oh yeah, that's the guy sleeping it off under the back seat. He drank his way across the country. And Bill realized you cannot get sober just on the book. This is a we program. You need another alcoholic. So that story was pulled immediately. It's only in the first edition, first printing. Again, AA being self-corrected, being divinely guided. And then in the fall of 1939, Hank started drinking again. So let me summarize the debt situation. We had 5,000 in outstanding stock certificates, a $2,500 loan from Charlie Towns, a $1,000 loan from Bert Taylor, a $1,000 loan from Fitz Mayo's sister. Fitz was AA number 3 in New York City. Total debt of about $190,000 and no income. The first glimmer of hope came from Cleveland, Ohio, a series of articles starting on October 21st, running through November 4th, 1939. Alcoholics Anonymous makes its stand there. This is still being reprinted today from the Cleveland Central Office. And in Cleveland, they started coming into the rooms fast and furious. There were 40 members of the Cleveland group, 400 inquiries, and it was Cleveland that came up with the idea of taking people through the steps as a group rather than individually, because they were coming in far faster than being able to sponsor them individually. Liberty Magazine, September 30th, 1939, published an article titled Alcoholics and God that turned more people off than on. It was a very, very misread of who we are. But then John D. Rockefeller interceded in our behalf and had a dinner for us in February of 1940. He invited 400 of his richest and closest friends. 75 of the Rockefeller invitees, along with 8 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, attended the affair. And we have that as a transcription. There was a stenographer in the room, and the entire evening festivities were recorded. One story, Morgan R., again, the guy that did the Gabriel Heater story, was sitting across, they had one alcoholic at each table. And a banker leans across and says, Mr. Ryan, what institution do you belong to? And he said, oh, well, not a part of any institution right now, but up until 6 months ago, I was in the Greystone Insane Asylum. That's an institution. And that really broke the ice between the alcoholics and the non-alcoholics. And people stood up gave glowing endorsements. Bill stood up. And then at the end, Nelson Rockefeller stood up and read this from his dad. Gentlemen, you can, John D. was ill that night, so his son actually read this for him. Gentlemen, you can all see that this is the work of goodwill. Its power lies in the fact that one member carries the good message to the next without any thought of financial income or reward. Therefore, it is our belief that Alcoholics Anonymous should be self-supporting where money is concerned. It needs only our goodwill. And Bill later writes, he saw $1 billion get up and walk right out of the room. He thought we needed a financial transfusion. We got our seventh tradition instead. But what happened is John D. Rockefeller bought 400 books. For each of the 400 that he invited, and that's what actually saved us during 1940. At the beginning of 1941, there were 2,000 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and something like 1,200 of them lived in Cleveland. Another 400 lived in Akron, and 400 lived in New York. So it was a three-city affair at that time. But everything changed. In terms of the Rockefeller, it was in the New York Times, the meeting that was held. Alcoholics Anonymous and Rockefeller made Time Magazine and Newsweek Magazine. That did help, at least to get things moving in a positive direction. But the Saturday Evening Post, March 1st, 1941, changed everything. There was an article written by Jack Alexander. He was hired by the Saturday Evening Post to expose Alcoholics Anonymous as a racket. He was a racket buster. Bill sat down with Jack in New York. Jack was actually from Washington, D.C., and said, before you write your article, all I ask is that you attend 10 meetings anonymously. From the feedback and the oral history, we believe that he attended meetings in Cleveland, Toledo, and Philadelphia. When he came back, he wrote the most glowing endorsement of Alcoholics Anonymous that's ever been written. The fellowship grew from 2,000 to 8,000 within 6 months of the publication, and we've never looked back. Sam Shoemaker, the leader of the Oxford Group in the United States in the 1930s, and the man Bill described as one of AA's founders, had this to say about Bill W. Sometimes God can take the mistaken and egotistical drives of a person and slowly refine these things until they are of great use to him and of great use to humanity. That's what happened to Bill. He thought he was the Messiah. He had to get this thing across to all the drunks of the world. Thank you, Sam. And thank God Bill did have the fortitude and the drive to move AA forward, even when there seemed to be no hope of its success. Bill was a visionary who could see 10 years down the road. As a result of his vision, millions of people in recovery today can proudly say, I'm a friend of Bill W.'s. Thank you, thank you, thank you.